car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener support community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. And we're broadcasting at 90.1 FM and webcast live at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, which is located at 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, you can visit www.centraliljwj.org. Once again, centraliljwj.org. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. He believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And we got a couple of special guests here in the studio today who we're going to get to as quickly as we can here. First, we got some news stories. It looks like in some local news, about 200 students and community members turned out for CU Students for Justice demonstration yesterday lining Springfield Avenue. Preschool, elementary, and middle school students marched alongside the high school students who called for the demonstration. Centennial High School students marched 3 hours in the cold, and you can check out some of these photos from the demonstration at www.flickr.com. And also in some local news, last spring a majority of non-tenure track faculty decided to form a union to improve their working conditions and the quality of education and research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Since the formation of the CFA, Local 6546, the administration has continued its long history of disrespect of NTT faculty by failing to recognize their union, freezing their wages, and refusing to bargain with them in a meaningful way. They want the administration to know that they're there and they're working, and they won't back down. And that working together in solidarity, they can achieve recognition, raises, and bargaining in good faith. So I think we had some of these members, CFA members, on the show not too long ago, and it was about a protest they were having in front of the alma mater, and then marched on the administration building. So it looks like that story is still in the works here in the community, and we'll probably be giving you future updates, and maybe somebody from the CFA can come in on a future program.
Dennis Dulia, he's a WEFT Airshifter.
That's correct. Yes.
Thursday
yes.
evenings from 6 to 8 o'clock. Another country. That's a great show here.
Okay. So. Good. So what do you have today, Bob?
Well, the past few weeks have also seen a significant labor agitation among graduate students at the University of Oregon. Graduate students announced the end of their strike, fought largely over sick leave, while Columbia University students announced their own fight for union recognition. If you tuned into last week's show, we had two representatives from the GEO here, and they mentioned the University of Oregon strike up there. So it says on December 2nd, 3 days before the end of fall semester classes, University of Oregon graduate student instructors walked off the job. It was the culmination of a year of failed negotiations between the university administration and the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation, the GTFF, which represents the graduate instructors, stretched back to November 2013. Organizing efforts among grad students began in the 60s with the TAA up at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, first being the first to be recognized as a bargaining unit. And the GTFF at the University of Oregon was formed back in 1976 and has fought with the university administration periodically in the years since. And the union has won major demands from the university in the past, such as employer-paid health care in 1993, but the union had never gone on strike. So this year, the strike ended with a tentative agreement that would create a $150,000 fund that members could use to cover lost wages as a result of leave for medical or parental leave, according to the Register Guard. Every graduate student, regardless of union membership, would be able to receive up to $1,000 for medical leave and up to $1,500 for a new child's birth, adoption, or foster placement. Mm-hmm. And the tentative deal also gives GTFFs a 5% pay raise for minimum wages retroactive to September 15th and another 5% increase next year. So that's all good news up there for the University of Oregon, folks.
Wow, that's pretty good. I mean, that's a pretty decent result.
They seem to, I think one of our guests can elaborate a little further.
Indeed.
But he mentioned that they seem to get everything that they had in their demands.
Mm-hmm.
Says also on the opposite coast, Columbia University research and teaching assistants are looking to become only the second unionized students at a private university. Last year, New York University became the first. So anyway, that's
Columbia University in New York City?
Columbia University, mm-hmm. Yeah, not in Chicago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Teaching assistants, they're hoping their university will also recognize their union despite not being legally required. They have a lengthy list of things they hope to negotiate for, including lower health insurance costs, greater job security, more regular and predictable paychecks, and more generous family leave policies. So,
okay.
Columbia University in New York.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, Bill, so what did you want to talk about?
Have you ever read The Strawberry Statement?
No. Wasn't that a movie back in the 60s?
Well, it was also a movie, but it was a 1968, this big action they had at Columbia University. They were good protesting them taking over like a close-by neighborhood and driving the low-income residents out and took over the administration building.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you have – what's of interest to you this week, Bill, that you've seen?
Well, actually, it came up this morning, so I'm not as prepared as I'd like to be about it. But what's happened is some writers on some, quote, liberal progressive sites – at least on a couple of them, Huffington Post and Addicting Info, especially the Addicting Info article, have really misinterpreted this new Supreme Court decision about people who work for a contractor at Amazon warehouses. Okay, and I'm basically, here's a nice short column by what's her name here? Anna North in yesterday's New York Times. I'm just going to go through it because it explains basically what happens, and I'll tell you how these are being misinterpreted.
Okay.
Okay, when you're at work, when you're actively buying, selling, or processing what you are hired to buy, sell, or process, certainly that is when you are at work, okay? But what about when you're doing something that may not be buying, selling, or processing per se, but that your boss insists that you do anyway? This week's Supreme Court decision in the case of Integrity Staffing Solutions Incorporated versus Busk threw that question into high relief. As Adam Liptak of The Times reports, the court ruled that Integrity, a temp agency, quote, was not required to pay workers at Amazon warehouses for the time they spent waiting to go through a security screening at the end of the day. All right, and this has to do with a 1947 law, the Portal to Portal Act. And basically what they're saying there is that contractors don't need to pay me to drive to work, mm-hmm. okay? Or they could work me, say I'm at the assembly hall and my car is parked way on the other side in the lot. They can have me work right up to 3:30
mm-hmm.
and not care about how long it takes me to walk to my car.
Okay.
You know,
In the instance of these Amazon employees, they had to wait in line as much as a half an hour to go through a security screening to make sure that they weren't stealing anything from the Amazon warehouses.
Uh-huh.
So they were already off the clock.
But still on the property.
Because Amazon doesn't hire enough security guards to get them all checked out quickly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So they weren't even out of the warehouse. They were still standing there as long as a half an hour, some of these employees.
Okay.
So. Yeah, well, see, and what's happening there is, Let me see down here. Some other writers, including this Scott Martell of the Los Angeles Times, he puts it like this, quote, if that is indeed the letter of the law, the Congress should change, or it's unconscionable that an employer can detain a worker on the work site for purposes of making sure the employee isn't stealing anything without paying for the time. If standing in that line for nearly 2.5 hours a week is a requirement of the job, then it should be seen and paid as part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, see, my boss is not telling me, or on these construction jobs, that's a different thing. You know, because we're just working there. The work is me pouring concrete.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not being required to stand somewhere for 25 minutes to wait to go out.
You know, okay. Now a construction analogy would be like if you're working for, say, a contractor, and in fact, you've done this as of just recently, to where, say, you're working over on 4th and Green, and then they want you to go over to Kraft in West Champaign. You get paid for the time you drive over there.
Oh, yeah, and on our contract, too, you do not drive to another job site during lunch
mm-hmm.
also. That's considered that you get a half-hour overtime if they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, this is like, say... If they were, what they're making this like is, the time between after they get through the security checkpoint to when they get to their car in the parking lot, which mm-hmm. is basically what I'm talking about. That's portal to portal.
Okay.
Okay. They're still inside the portal.
And I think the main point is like Bob said, they don't hire enough security. Yeah. People to check people out in an expedient manner. I mean, if it took 5 or even
right.
10 minutes, that would be, I think, acceptable to most workers. But you know, 30 minutes or more. I mean, that's quite a long time to not get paid for. You know, the time.
Well, I'll say when we were building the power plant,
mm-hmm.
we weren't getting searched on the way out. We did have to go through the brass alleys, which mm-hmm. slowed things up.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like we were being searched and made to stand there. It's just that, you know, you're in the back of the line,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting out. So that, but anyway, the thing that people have been misinterpreting, there was this article in Addicting Info is where I first came across this
mm-hmm.
this morning. And Justice Thomas makes a statement that this is a condition of work. It doesn't fall under the Fair Labor Standards Act. However, it is something that should be bargained, or that should come up at the bargaining table.
Thomas said that, huh? That's surprising.
Well, yeah, but you see, he's talking, and this guy who's writing for Addicting Info is like, oh, well then he's saying that right to work laws are unconstitutional or wrong. And no, he's not. He's just saying that, well, if you want to work for these people at Amazon, when you go in and talk about it, you need to tell them that you want to get paid for that. Mm-hmm. And if they don't want to pay you, then libertarian would say, you're free to go find another job.
Right. He's not talking necessarily a collective bargaining,
right.
kind of individual bargaining, which of course, as we all know, is just, you know, that's the surest way to lose your job.
Mm-hmm. Well, then another thing too, there's unions doing collective bargaining in right-to-work states.
Of course, yeah.
And this is also having to do with comments on these articles I'm seeing, because there's somebody making a comment from Texas. He says he lives in Texas, and while he can join a union there, they can't have collective bargaining. Hmm. Well, I even looked up the Texas law on the right-to-work law, you know, and see right-to-work just... Well, it's a misnomer, but I'm going to use it because it's the common term.
Mm-hmm.
And all that means is that there is no... You cannot be discriminated against for being a member of a union or not being a member of the union
mm-hmm.
in any situation.
Okay.
It's just, you cannot have a closed shop.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, folks, that's all that's about. This is about, what they're comparing this to is, me having to show up 5 minutes early to get my concrete boots on,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, or something like that. Well, no, we don't do that.
Right, or pick up your tools on your own time at the end of the day.
Right, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Right.
Well, and in our contracts, you know, the end of the, you know, we pick up tools at 15 minutes before the end of the day on the building and trades, but we don't do it on the heavy highway.
Mm. Oh, really?
Because on heavy highway, you're just throwing the stuff in the truck.
Well, also you get a little bit more money on heavy highway too, right?
Laborers do, finishers don't.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, that's inside baseball.
Yeah, and Bob?
I just wanted to point out, because we mentioned this before we went on the air, that this was a unanimous decision in the Supreme Court.
9-0.
Nine to zero. So it wasn't just Judge Thomas that was deciding this.
Yes.
It was all nine of them that agreed on it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also, Amazon workers went on strike in two warehouses in Germany this week.
Okay. Well, so, let's keep...
But they probably are actually employed by Amazon.
As opposed to a temp agency.
Yeah, because Germany probably doesn't allow this stuff.
Subcontractors.
Oh, there's another thing, too. The Obama administration also put in a brief in support of this law.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not surprising. Okay.
But see, the thing is, though, it is really settled case law from that night, from earlier decisions, so it's not surprising that they all would.
Okay.
They would feel bound to go for it.
Okay. I got a quick public service announcement, and then we're going to take a quick music break and come to our guests here. So, police say that they would not use the MRAP vehicle. That's the armored personnel carrier that the Champaign Sheriff's Department has. It's saying that the police said they would not use the MRAP against peaceful protesters, but we know from public records obtained that local police were sent to the NATO summit in Chicago in May of 2012, where thousands demonstrated. Urbana sent three of its officers. They name them by name. University of Illinois police also sent three officers who are named by are actually given their names, and the Champaign County Sheriff sent two deputies, and they also named their names. Champaign police sent one officer. Will police be mobilized against nonviolent protesters in Urbana-Champaign? Come and tell the Urbana City Council no to police militarization, and that's this coming Monday at the Urbana City Building on Vine Street in Urbana, right across just due east of Lincoln Square at 6:30. That's this Monday, Urbana City Council meeting at 6:30 p.m. Council meeting starts at 7, but people will be gathering in the lobby for a brief protest, if you will, at a half an hour before the scheduled start of the City Council meeting. So anyway, we're going to take a quick music break here, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on the Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. And anyway, so now I'd like our two special guests to introduce themselves, and we'll sort of get into this discussion about the topic today. So,
sure. Well, thank you for having me back on today. I really appreciate it. This is an important topic, but my name is Grant Anteline. I'm a community organizer here in Champaign, Illinois. I've been organizing for about 10 years in this community, lived here for about 20 plus, And right now I currently work at the Graduate Employees Organization, Local 6300, as a community organizer. Yeah, we have some amazing opportunities coming up. Most of what I'll be talking about today is based on my experience as a community organizer with Champaign County Healthcare Consumers doing healthcare justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of the general theme of our program today is sort of legal self-defense for working people. And, you know, medical debt, of course, is it's huge. I mean, I just saw this article this morning, actually, that nearly 20% of U.S. consumers with credit records, that's 42.9 million people, have unpaid medical debts, according to a new report by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the findings suggest that many Americans are being trapped by debt because they are confused by notices they get from hospitals and insurance companies about the cost of treatment, on and so forth. But, yes, I mean, and this is one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in the United States at this point in time. So, also, could you introduce yourself to our other guest?
Certainly. My name is Mike Antoline. I'm an attorney here in Champaign. I practice here. And I'm best known as being Grant Antoline's father.
Okay, very good. Okay, so anyway, we got a kind of a general outline here that you guys were very, I'm glad you provided this because it really can help us focus in here, on the topic today. And, anyway, it starts out, I like this how this starts out. In the world of creditor debtor disputes, the deck is often stacked against the debtor. So let's just start there.
Well, sure. Let me, frame, this a little bit. So in this community, the kind of odd thing about Champaign County is we have a lot of wealth, but we also have an extreme amount of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And the wealth disparity here poses some significant issues for people to live and be happy. One of those that I experienced early on in my organizing career was the issue of medical debt. When I worked for Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, my very first project was to research medical debt cases here in Illinois at all of the, Champaign County at the institutions we had. So that would be Carle Hospital, Carle Clinic, Christie Clinic, and what was Provena at the time, now is Presence. And through my research, I found that a huge number of people were being sued by these institutions. I saw lawsuits for as little as $46.
That doesn't even seem like it's worth their time to go to court.
In fact, when I talk about it, I would say if I was the attorney suing that individual for $46, I would pull out my wallet and say, here's a freebie.
Yeah.
Go home. This isn't worth my time. And it damn sure ain't worth your time either. So these cases just kept stacking up and stacking up. And what we identified was that our local healthcare institutions actually created a healthcare crisis here in order to affect reimbursement rates from the state. They actually colluded together illegally and said, we are not going to see Medicaid patients. We are not going to see other patients. We are going to establish these policies at both competing institutions to essentially price fix. And what resulted is the needless suffering and death of a lot of individuals here in this community at the hands of...
Said death, not debt, right?
No, death.
Okay.
But the after effect of those people who were able to survive their ailments and the lack of care is the medical debt.
Mm-hmm.
Homes were taken, wages were garnished, bench warrants issued. We had many clients who actually graced the front of the Wall Street Journal who were jailed for medical debt.
Bill, didn't you know one of those people?
Yeah, he'd been here too, Jim Bean.
Mm-hmm.
And they called that body attachment.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And he was actually on Democracy Now! 2 years ago after that Wall Street Journal story.
Okay.
So we identified these huge glaring issues, and when I would speak to them with my father, we would kind of identify some specific things that people who are having to defend themselves in court in small claims maybe weren't aware of, and the need to get educated on how to defend yourself. You really are left to the wolves when you go into court and defend yourself as a debtor, and so. My father, who is an amazing attorney here, has prepared some kind of guidelines, standard practices that people can maybe look into or adopt if
okay.
they are suffering.
Right. Well, the reality of the situation is that in the world of debtor and creditor disputes, the deck is pretty much stacked against the debtor. Now, let's just define our terms here. The creditor obviously is someone to whom money is owed for a reason. That could be a bank, it could be a mortgage company, it could be a hospital, for example. The debtor is the person that owes the money. Now, when I say the debt is stacked against the debtor, you go into court sometimes and there's just disputes where there's absolutely on opposite sides of the dispute. One person says they did it, one person says they didn't. When you go into a court in a debtor-creditor dispute, 99% of the time the debtor owes the money in whole or in part. So strike one. All right, but don't give up yet. All right, secondly, the creditors are the big money interests to whom the money is owed, and they can always afford to hire an attorney to go into court on their behalf. So a creditor goes into court with an attorney, a debtor, you're probably already in some financial difficulty, mm-hmm. so you really don't have the money to hire an attorney, and that's strike two. All right, now, to give you an example of how the deck is stacked, let's back up for just a second. In law school, attorneys are taught some core principles of the law. You know, you'll take a course in criminal law, criminal procedure, civil procedure, contracts, real estate, and things like that, and you get a basic grounding in those core principles. But they teach you a lot in law school. A lot of time is spent teaching you how to find the law in various areas. You know, you have to consult cases, you'll have to consult statutes. But one very convenient thing that you consult is something called secondary sources or treatises. Okay, so you go outside and you find these treatises on a particular topic of the law, and they are done usually by experts in the field or attorneys who practice there for a long time or legal scholars or something of that nature. Well, just for fun, I went to the Illinois Institute of Continuing Legal Education this morning before I came on. I looked up the resources in terms of secondary materials treatises that were available to creditors' rights attorneys, the attorneys representing the people to whom the money is owed. There's a treatise about 400 or 500 pages long on that.
Oh.
Then I went and I looked for the material that helps attorneys represent debtors. There's a pamphlet that's about 24 pages.
Oh, wow. It
gives you an example of what's happening here. Furthermore, the structure of the law in the state of Illinois tends to favor creditors. Statute of limitations is a length of time beyond which a case cannot be brought. You know, evidence gets stale, people pass away, documents are lost. So almost every cause of action in the state has a statute of limitations. Illinois has the second longest statute of limitations for debt collection. So the debtor, you can have a debt out there. If it's a written contract, it can be out there for as much as 10 years, and they can still come
wow.
after you.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, folks, this is in a state that is ruled by Democrats. You know, and it's probably – I mean, I really wish that Whitney would have ran again and that the Green Party would have had a slot in the ticket. I bet they could have got 30%. Of the vote.
Man. Well,
I think
yeah,
a lot
with
of
this recent gubernatorial
win.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so interesting. What's the first state? What's the state that has the longest?
The state that has the longest statute of limitations is there's only one other state that mm-hmm. has longer than Illinois, and that's Kentucky, and that's 15 years.
Wow.
Illinois bankruptcy law is pretty. I mean, you can't hardly keep anything. In Illinois, it's nowhere near as generous as a federal bankruptcy law or many other states.
Mm. Okay. Well, anyway, so back on this here. Okay, so that's sort of the situation a debtor is faced with when they go into court. What does a debtor do then?
What's the best
strategy?
All right. Well, first of all, the best thing to do is try to stay out of court if you can. Try to stay away from the courtroom. Mm. As I said, the cards are stacked against you. You probably don't want to walk into an arena where there's, you know, 10 lions and no weapons to fight with. But that's basically what you're happening when you have to go to court. Try to negotiate with a creditor if you can. Now, if it appears you can't negotiate with the creditor, think about asking an attorney to write a letter for you. Now, that is generally fairly inexpensive. But if the creditor knows that you are either are or are going to be, or there's a possibility you're going to be represented by an attorney, it casts an entirely different light on this situation. I'll explain to you a little bit more in detail why later on. But try to negotiate. If you can't negotiate, have an attorney. Now, an attorney's going to have to look over your paperwork, okay, because he's not going to want to write a letter that is untruthful. He's not going to want to write a letter that has he's going to want a valid and cogent argument to make in the letter. So he needs to look over your papers. He can probably develop some type of argument, either that you don't owe the debt, either that, or perhaps you don't know all of the debt, or perhaps some of the charges on there are erroneous. So let the attorney, give the attorney a break. Let him see as much of your paperwork as you still have. All right, now, if the attorney writes a letter and you still can't get anywhere and you are served with a summons and complaint, okay, what do you do then? Well, first of all, don't fail to show up in court. It's extremely important that you go. And the reason that it's important is because, well, first, the first time you show up in court is generally called a first appearance. And nothing's going to happen there except you coming into court and either telling the judge that you either owe the money or that you don't owe the money, okay? So first appearances are kind of easy in this whole prospect, okay? Now, if you do show up in court, well, let me put the let's look at the worst-case analysis. Let's say you don't show up, okay? The creditor could potentially take a default judgment against you. Now, what would happen is that the creditor basically throws some papers at the judge, and the judge has nobody else to listen to. The judge has to be an impartial observer. He can't argue on behalf of someone not there. And even if you are there, the judge can't argue on your behalf. So he pretty much has to take what is given to him and basically grant the relief requested, unless there are some really serious jurisdictional problems or something of that nature. But you're likely to get a default judgment against you. Okay. Now, once the default judgment is taken against you, and let me also say that default judgments can be for amounts of money that you just don't owe. Generally it's not the case. Generally creditors' attorneys, again, have to follow the rules. But sometimes the creditor attorney's client may throw in interest rates. They may throw in late fees that may not be called for in the contract. So the attorney is going to represent his client. He's going to give it to the judge, and you may wind up being socked with money you just don't owe. Okay, let's say a judgment is entered against you. What can they do to you? You know, they say, well, we can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. Well, believe me, there's still blood in the turnip. They can file something called a citation to discover assets, and they can call you back into court, and they can make you bring with you a great deal of information about your assets. They can find out where you work. They can find out if you have any benefits. They can find out if you're on unemployment. They can find out if you're on Social Security. They can find out if you own any real estate. They can find out if you have a checking account, if a savings account, money market certificate. They can find out if you have a safe deposit box. They can find out what kind of vehicles you're driving, if you own any jewelry, if you have any gold, if you have any. They can find out if you have stocks, bonds. They'll ask if you have a personal computer. They'll ask if you have a DVD player. They'll ask if you have a television, a stove, a microwave. Do you have work tools? Do you have business equipment, farm equipment? They can ask you about any assets that you have, all of which may be attachable. And they may take it away from you in order to sell, in order to satisfy your debt. So it's really important that you go.
They can take your home away from you?
Well,
what you're saying?
Potentially, Bob. They could potentially do that, but there are some protections in the state of Illinois about you can have assets with so much equity that might be protected, et cetera. But
are there some assets, like say a vehicle, let's say a $1,000 value car that, that's kind of almost a necessity more or less. I guess what I'm getting at is there are certain things like that that
yes.
would be exempt. Okay.
There's certain limited things, and generally vehicles are one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it depends on how much equity do you have, the value of the car.
Sure.
I would imagine that the court could say, well, you've got a $50,000 automobile. You need to get it to work. Sell it, buy a $3,000 automobile, and take the rest of the money to pay your debt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that would be likely or not, but nonetheless,
okay.
The point being is when you fail to go to court, you really open yourselves up to some pretty damaging things that could happen to you. Okay, now you're served with a citation to discover assets, and you don't show up for that. Well. The attorney can come in and says, Judge, I would like a writ for body attachment. Another name for that is an arrest warrant. Yeah. Now, generally, police agencies don't necessarily always go out and knock on your door to execute these kinds of warrants. But let's say you're driving down the highway and on your way to a concert that you wanted to see for a long time, and you happen to be pulled over for speeding. If you got a warrant, you're not going to the concert, you're going to jail. So, again, don't avoid court appearances. All right. If you have to go to court, I've seen this happen so often. A courtroom is a place where people try to get at the truth. And consequently, there's some decorum that is respected and adhered to. And if you go to court, don't wear the tube tops and the Daisy Dukes. Don't wear the ball caps. Put them aside. Your freedom of expression that you exercise through what you wear is certainly your right, but it's imprudent to exercise that freedom of expression in a courtroom because you need to walk in. You need to walk in looking like you're credible. So try to avoid that if you can. I've seen it happen. Okay. I've seen somebody come into a courtroom with a t-shirt, a young woman that said, I got the blank. I make the rules. I'll let you fill in the blank. Okay. On that one, the judge said, young lady, go home, change and come back when you have something respectable on. Okay. I've seen it happen a dozen times. Try to also speak respectfully both to the judge and the other attorney. Now, I'll tell you, judges don't like personal acrimony in the courtroom. They don't like people fighting, and they don't like it among attorneys, and they don't like it among anybody. So if there's another attorney there, try to be respectful to that gentleman or lady. Judges hate it. It's a waste of their time, and it makes it just that much more difficult to get through what would otherwise be a lengthy and sometimes a difficult proceeding. So avoid that if you can. All right. The judge is going to ask you whether you admit or deny the allegations of the complaint. My advice is, first of all, don't lie. And also, try not to be evasive. Okay? The judge will pick up on that, and your credibility will be harmed. Okay? The best thing to do, and you can always usually have a rational, truthful basis to say this, is to tell the judge that you are confused about some of the allegations in the complaint, suggest to the judge that you'd like to have time to study them, suggest to the judge that you may want to consult with an attorney, or consult again with the attorney that you had previously consulted with for your letter, and then ask the judge for more time. Now, the judge can set the case over, or he can set it for trial. Now, in a busy court like Champaign County, your trial may be a couple of months out on this, and the judge may not even set it for trial. He may even just set it to allow you to maybe consult an attorney. If you have to go back into court, if the judge just sets it over and you go back into court, the judge may remember you asked for time to consult with an attorney. If you don't come back in with an attorney, be prepared to explain why. Judge, I couldn't afford it. I tried to talk to somebody. I couldn't afford it. Now, again, judges are not there to advocate for you, but the judges want to be fair. They want to be fair, and they want to give you an opportunity to argue your case to the best of your ability. So the judge is more than likely going to give you some time.
Also, it seems like what I've seen of courts is that the judges like, it seems like they like to have the plaintiff and the defendant, the debtor and creditor, work something out, you know. Does it seem like, I mean, because of the, you think that's partly because of the heavy caseload that they're just trying to get things off the dockets, or what's that dynamic about?
Well, settlement is always favored. Settlement is favored not only by judges, but it's favored in the law.
Mm-hmm.
Settlement is actually worked into the legal system to make it easy. Now, let me give you an example of that, for example. Let's say you're talking to your creditor about and entering into settlement negotiations, and let's say you're exchanging letters, okay? And let's say you make certain admissions in those letters. That kind of communication regarding settlement is generally not admissible in court as evidence. They can't bring it into court because the court doesn't want people to avoid attempting to engage in settlement negotiations for fear of having it used against them in court. Mm-hmm. So that's not part of the evidence. They won't let that into evidence. That's an example of the way our law system is structured. A lot of people blame attorneys for a great deal of litigation in this society, but in reality, 95% of the cases are settled before they get to court. So in my opinion, attorneys turn out to be one of the biggest, greatest peacemakers in the society. A lot of cases are settled out of court, by the way. All right, now, let's say, for example, that you are scheduled for trial, and let us say that you're not able to have an attorney there with you. There are still some things that you can do. Okay. Number one, first of all, figure out who's suing you. If it's the original creditor, can be problematic. Because usually the original creditor is probably local. There may be somebody there to testify on behalf of the original creditor. But that's not usually the case. Okay, banks are in the business of banking, and they don't like to send their people to court. Hospitals are in the business of giving health care, and they don't want to send their people into court. But what they do a lot of time is they either assign a debt for collection or a debt buyer comes in and buys the debt. Okay, now when I say buys the debt, some of these big corporations, Capital One, for example, has a huge amount of uncollectible debt. They don't have time to fiddle with it. They want to increase their cash flow, so they go out to debt buyers and they offer them, you know, $400,000 in collectible loans, or loans that are outstanding. I shouldn't say collectible, loans that are outstanding. And these debt buyers can sometimes buy that debt for pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they buy the debt, and then there's an assignment to the debt collector. An assignment is a contract whereby the creditor gives the loan and the ability to collect the loan, the ownership of the loan, the ownership of the debt, to the debt buyer. Okay. If you have that situation, you have a pretty fair shot at some good defenses. And let me give you an example of a couple of those. All right. If a debt buyer comes into court and attempts to collect, according to the Illinois Rules of Civil Procedure, they have to prove chain of title. And sometimes not only will a debt buyer, there will be an original debt buyer that actually negotiated with the creditor, there'll be a chain of buyers of debt. So you could be two or three people down the chain of debt collectors.
Hasn't this been coming up in a lot of these mortgage foreclosures? In fact, wasn't there a congressperson that told people that they just, you know, needed to find out if whoever came to court was actually the people who owned the debt?
Exactly. Bill, the mortgage foreclosure debacle is just, we could do probably a week's worth of radio broadcasts on that alone. But no, that is absolutely right. And we're going to really touch on that here in just a second. Take a look at the complaint and see if the documents regarding chain of title are attached.
Hmm.
Okay. If they aren't, here's where you have to think a little bit strategically. you don't want to call the attorney at the other side up and say, hey, where's the chain of title documents? He's liable to go out and get them, okay? You may want to hold that off until you actually get to court, okay? Now, some of these debt buyers are big corporations. They buy a lot of debt, and they ship this stuff out to collection attorneys who, in turn, may hire other attorneys to go out and actually make the court appearances for them. For example, I was in a case recently where there was a big law firm in Chicago that had sent a collection to a Danville attorney and for him to come to court. And a lot of these debt collection agencies sort of play it by the percentages. They'll buy a lot of debt for pennies on the dollar. They're not hurt very much on that with that kind of situation. And they'll throw a bunch of these cases out there, hoping that the debtor doesn't show up. And they get a default judgment. And then they go and they do a paycheck garnishment or something like that, and they get their money without having to put a lot of effort into it. Now, there's a lot of these debt collection companies and debt buyers play the odds. And they throw them out there, and apparently it works for them. Apparently they make money doing that. But nonetheless, a lot of time their paperwork is pretty shoddy, and the complaint may not have proof of the chain of title. If it has some documents attached to the complaint, for example, then you need to look carefully at those. And that's where we come into something called the hearsay rule in court. All right, hearsay is defined as a statement made out of court that is offered in court as evidence to prove the truth of what is said, of the matter asserted. Okay. Now, here's an example. Mr. X testifies on the stand that Mr. Y told him that the contract was forged. Objection, Your Honor, hearsay. Okay. And that would probably be sustained unless there was a counterargument made that it falls within one of the 14 or 15 hearsay rule exceptions. There's a lot of them. Okay. But nonetheless, hearsay cannot be admitted. Now, I mentioned exceptions to the hearsay rule. One of the exceptions you're going to run into in debtor-creditor litigation, you're going to run into the business records exception to the hearsay rule. Now, a business record is a document prepared in the normal course of business. Okay. So let's say that a bank loans you some money, you sign a promissory note. That document is prepared in the normal course of business. And let's say that the creditor comes along and offers that in court under the business records exception. There needs to be at least an affidavit attached to that that says that this is a true and correct copy, maybe even the original of a document that we prepare, representing a promissory note that we prepare in the ordinary course of business, okay, to get it in with the exception, okay? Now, the judge probably will take that into evidence, okay? Now, but you need to look at that. Who signed the affidavit? If a debt buyer has purchased that debt and they have one of their people sign it, this is a true and correct copy of the note that we received from the creditor, original creditor in this matter. That's not going to get it into evidence because that is still here. That's hearsay. You got to have people, either the custodian of the original records or the author of the original records. You got to have them testify that it's a business record that's created in the course of business. You can't let somebody else come in and testify that. So look and see who does the affidavits there. That's very important because you could keep the contract out of evidence. Mm-hmm. And if the judge looks at that and says, you know, this is absolutely right. I'm not going to admit this into evidence. The other attorney's standing there, nothing to do. Nothing to do. Okay? All right. Now, some other examples of business records, receipts, collection letters, assignment documents, things of that nature. Now, we mentioned the assignment document. That's a contract between the original creditor and the debt buyer, gives them the loan to collect. Okay. We're going to get to something very important in just a minute. Okay. Debt buyers have to prove the chain of title by business records. Those business records have to be properly authenticated by valid affidavits. Okay, it's important to note that affidavits are admitted only to support the business record, only to lay a foundation for the business record. Anything else in that affidavit, if that, even if it's from the original creditor, if it says, this guy owes this much in interest, this guy, owes this much in late fees, et cetera, none of that is admissible. Because again, that, the business, it's the business record that is admissible, not ancillary information in an affidavit. That's not admissible. Okay, so make sure and look at the content of the affidavits and don't let that – affidavits can be admitted for limited purpose to show the foundation of the business records, and the judge can exclude all the rest of it. Well, I'm not going to let test – this is hearsay testimony on the interest rate and the fees owed. I'm not going to let that in, but I'll go ahead and accept the business record. All right, now, if you have an assignment – remember the chain of title? There may be one assignment, there may be two assignments, et cetera. Okay. A lot of times, big companies will sell a portfolio of debt. They'll say, well, we're gonna sell all these debts that total $400,000, we're gonna sell them to you, Mr. Debt Buyer. Okay. If the assignment doesn't list your loan, that's the subject of the lawsuit, it's not worth the paper it's written on. Mm-hmm. It has to specify somewhere in that document, either in the appendix or in the document itself, it has to specify your loan. Because what the company did with portfolio loans doesn't say what the company did with your particular case. So that has to be, done. Now, another little interesting trick here is if they try to introduce a facsimile copy of an assignment and without any kind of authenticity there, the rule is you got to submit the original or you got to explain to the court why the original is not available and have some kind of support that the copy that is produced is a true and correct copy of the original. So if they just submit a raw facsimile copy, say, Judge, this is a facsimile. It's not the original. I don't think it should be admitted. Judge is going to agree with you because he knows the law. Okay. Now, another thing to look at, okay, and this is kind of an interesting twist, and this gets to be a little bit of a refined legal concept, but sometimes debtors and creditors will – or excuse me, sometimes creditors produce what they claim are business records – that will help them in litigation. Okay? So let's say that you have an automobile accident. Let's say that you're uninsured and the other guy's insurance company sues you in court to collect on an agreement you made with them to pay them back a certain amount of money. Okay, it's not an automobile accident that's being sued on, it's an agreement. A contract that you said, okay, I pay $50 a month for the next 20 months, okay? If they try to submit an accident report that they prepared, there's the distinction. Documents prepared in anticipation of litigation are not business records. They are not prepared ordinarily in the ordinary course of supporting someone's business. Mm-hmm. They're prepared in anticipation of going to court. And although, you know, collection may be part of part and parcel, that's not meet the definition of a business record. Okay. All right. Other thing to look for in the assignment, and it's really important to read these documents, okay? Sometimes a creditor, and this happens very frequently, sometimes a creditor will not warrant to a debt buyer the accuracy of its own records. And this is something they put in their comment because those guys make mistakes. And if the debt buyer says, hey, you guys gave me faulty information, I couldn't collect this debt, I shouldn't be responsible for it or give us our money back or something like that. A lot of creditors, when they assign debt, put those waiver of warranties in there. We don't warrant that these records are back. There are some courts that have held that if the creditor won't warrant the accuracy of the records to the debt buyer can't bring him into court. Because they're, you know, there's no guarantee that they're accurate. So those are some finely tuned legal arguments you can use to try to knock a case out. Now let me give you a real life example if we have time.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick music break here real fast and then we're going to be right back and can't wait to hear this. This is really fascinating. You've been listening to World Labor Hour on WFT Community Radio Champaign. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back. That was Tom Morello. And anyway, so we're this has been really fascinating discussion. So, Mike, you've got just to some other a few more things to say on this, and then we're kind of got the little related topic to just briefly mention before we go to the union edge here.
Thanks, Dave. Just one real life example that occurred recently, and I frankly don't do a lot of collection debtor creditor work in court, but. One person called on me for some help who was a friend of mine and I decided to help him out. And, that person had a debt, that was in the neighborhood of $7,000. And that kind of money creditors usually want to go after. But it was, the result of some, medical procedures that were done and it was required that she go out and borrow the money to have those medical procedures performed. Well, she entered into a contract, signed a promissory note with a banking institution, and as it turned out, some of the medical, they were actually dental procedures, that some of the dental procedures were not done properly.
Okay? Oh.
And, she disputed about $2,000 to $3,000 worth of debt. Okay. Here is a central distinction here. The creditor won't care if you got the services that you paid for, and this is true of a lot of credit cards. For example, you buy a TV, it's a lemon, or a car, it's a lemon. The person that loads you money don't care, and the court won't either. Okay, your problem is with the person that provided you the services or provided you the shoddy products, not with the person that loaned you the money. So you can't even raise that in court, actually. There's a French idiom that pretty much sums this up. It basically, the translation is "not my circus, not my monkeys." Okay. So, you know, the creditor doesn't have an interest in what you did. They borrowed you, they loaned you. You're suing on the note, not on the product that you got. Okay. Well, that was one issue here. So we covered that issue, and actually, we went to court, and we were scheduled for trial that day. And this is something you should never do to your attorney, but the person approached me about 2 days before the trial. Okay, approached me on Friday. The trial was on Monday. Okay. Well, anyhow, you do the best you can. Try not to do that because it's not your best interest, because the quicker the attorney has to work, sometimes things are overlooked, and you don't want to put him in that position. But anyway, we looked through the documents. This was a major banking corporation that had loaned the money. There was a debt buyer that had bought the debt. And there was a law firm in Chicago that was retained by the debt buyer to collect, and they had hired a local attorney. By the time the paperwork may not have ever been there to begin with, but the time that it passed through three different sets of hands, there wasn't much there. And the law firm, again, playing the percentages, just sent the guy into court, sent the attorney, the local attorney, into court, hoping that somebody wouldn't show up, they'd get a default judgment. Okay. Well, not only did she showed up with an attorney. Okay. So we go out in the hallway. The court usually always allows you time for attorneys to confer. We go out in the hallway, and the guy says, well, are you going to provide some affirmative defenses? Well, I had about 9 of them based on the way that paperwork was set up. But I wasn't going to tell him what they were.
Sure.
Okay. And I said, well, I'm going to have to enter my appearance, and we're probably going to have to get this matter rescheduled. And he says, well, he looked through his paperwork. He says, I'm going to take a voluntary dismissal. Okay. Now, what that didn't absolve the person of the debt. A voluntary dismissal in the state of Illinois, even if the statute of limitations is run, allows the person taking the voluntary dismissal to refile within a year. So sometimes you can actually extend the statute of limitations by doing that. But in any event, he took the voluntary dismissal. Now, what will happen is that case will go back up the chain, okay, and they're going to look at it, and they're going to say, this gal has hired an attorney. The case is old. The case was like about 8 or 9 years old. I don't know if we can get the original documentation. Let's just forget about it. And there's a 50-50 chance that they probably won't even refile this case.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just let it go. Again, they played the odds. This is one that didn't work out for them. Most of them do. That's why they roll the dice. So that was one example. They didn't have their act together when they went into court. We had our act together, and we got them to back off.
Okay. That's really interesting about, you hear all this about outsourcing and everything, and I guess this is one thing where it's actually helped the average person out there, is sometimes it seems like the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing with all the various stages of outsourcing. But Grant, we're just about out of time here, and Grant, you had something you wanted to mention in relation to medical debt?
Yeah. So all the tips that you just learned from Michael Antoline about how you can really stand up for yourself in small claims court against a creditor, there are some ways to tackle medical debt before it gets that far. And one of those things that I think a lot of people may be aware of, but maybe not, is that any nonprofit hospital or healthcare institution. So in this area, we have Presence and we have Carle Foundation. They are required by federal law to have community care programs because we pay their taxes. And there's a huge issue with the Carle taxes in Urbana right now, as a lot of folks are aware of. But we pay those taxes, and as a payback to the community, they are required to have these programs to help people who cannot afford health care. And Carle Hospital's community care program is actually quite good. It has a very good tiered system based on income. I don't even think maybe this has changed, because it does change frequently, but some assets aren't even looked at.
Mm-hmm. How do these?
I have experience with this. Back in 2009, when everything went completely to hell around here in the building trades, I had some health problems. I had a couple of situations where I had to stay in Carl for some time, and they didn't even look at like my that I owned a house or anything like that. But they knocked 75% off of my. Not deductible, co-payment.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah. So, that's pretty good.
Do you have to, can you apply for these, sign up for these in advance of a medical problem, or do you have to wait until you actually have the medical problem?
That's, one of the great things about the program here is, you can have this debt for a while. Medical procedures have already been done. You're out of therapy. You are back on your feet and back at work.
Mm-hmm.
You get a bill that came to collections, and you bring it to Carl. You sign up for the program. It does work retroactively up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
Presence's healthcare or community care program is adequate, but usually the rule of thumb I tell people is if you have to have a procedure done, you're worried about paying for it, go to Carl. And the last thing I want to say on this is, I have seen through my research at Healthcare Consumers, literally people's lives destroyed. That's why unions are bargaining so hard for healthcare contracts that actually mean something for their members, because they know in their heart that one instance in a lifetime of being healthy and financially stable, one instance of serious illness can throw you into bankruptcy. So, if you have medical debt, if you're listening right now and you have trouble paying your bills, you need help navigating that system. I would, before it goes to court, because at that point I would actually seek the advice, or counsel of an attorney if you can afford it, or follow some of the steps that my father has laid out, in this program. But also I would contact Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. They can advocate on your behalf. They can navigate you through the process. They can even sign you up for these programs right in-house. Their number is 217-352-6533. You can reach them on the web at www.healthcareconsumers.org. Give them a call if you're at all in doubt of your ability to pay for a medical bill. They will help.
Okay. Yeah, and even if you do have insurance, at 20%, copayments can really climb.
Exactly.
You have serious illness.
These are good things to know. Of course, the ultimate solution is Medicare for all.
And, exactly.
You know, but until we get there, it's going to be a long
healthcare
fight.
Healthcare is a constitutional right.
Yes. And of course, I mean, it's going to be a long protracted fight because there's a lot of money involved in private healthcare.
Yes, sir.
In the meantime, we have to know how to survive and navigate this system. And so
that's
I thank you both very much for coming on the show today. And
thank you.
Helping a lot of maybe working people out there that might need this. So you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.